This episode is brought to you by the incoming first year graduate students. Y'all are going to kill it. Welcome back, everybody, to My Fave Great Chemist. I'm your host, Geraldo.
And I'm Beth. And we're really excited for y'all to listen to this week's episode.
We hope you are staying safe and healthy out there. Here's our show.
Today, we are so excited to introduce y'all to a truly incredible graduate student. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, hello, my name is Emily Norwine. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. I did my undergraduate studies at Boston University, where I worked with Professor Linda Dorr on a synthetic inorganic project. So that was where I first got into inorganic chemistry. Generally doing a synthetic project generating a copper complex that we reacted with molecular oxygen, which made a really cool reactive trimer, and then further studied the reactivity of that. So that was really cool to get introduced to all of that. But yeah, now I'm officially a third year, I guess, at the University of Michigan in the chemistry department, where I work in the lab of Professor Nate Simchak, still staying strong with a synthetic inorganic project focusing on coordination chemistry, where I develop and study ligand platforms that actually contain intramolecularly appended Lewis acids, and then we can further study the reactivity that's imparted by those, like substrate capture and small molecule activation, which is certainly the goal. But yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Inorganic chemistry is like, I feel like I understand so little of it that I'm like amazed.
Yeah, I know. I did an REU in medicine where I worked with inorganic. It was like kind of material inorganic, and I was like, synthesizing catalysts. I was like, what the hell? These techniques are so weird. Like synthesis, inorganic synthesis is so weird. But no, it's cool.
I mean, I get to work with glove boxes, and I think that everybody who knows anything about me knows that my three loves are my partner, Anna, my chinchilla, Luna, and my glove box.
That's good. I feel like organic chemists, like, I am like, glove boxes, please never make me use one ever. So it's nice to hear that there are people who love glove boxes.
Yeah, but, I've learned to love my glove boxes, you know, working with like, organometallic stuff. So. That's good.
All right, so let's jump into it. So let's start off with a little bit about your undergraduate career. So can you tell us about your experience as an undergrad at Boston University, and how did you find your way to inorganic chemistry?
Yeah, so I absolutely loved my time at Boston University. I know that Boston University is definitely a place where once you get on campus, it's really either for you or not, but I definitely fell under that. It was for me. I love being in the city environment, but I guess more than that, I really love being a chemistry major at BU, because although it's a campus of, I think, more than 16,000 undergraduates, so certainly a large school, my chemistry major in my class was less than 50 people. And so it was a really great place where even though I was in a city and in a giant environment with a huge community, I then had a much smaller community and a really tight-knit group of really close friends that I ended up with through working in chemistry. And so that was just sort of chemistry in general. But then when I was a sophomore, I was talking to my academic advisor, and he was saying, oh, well, if you aren't exactly sure what you want to do in the future, but maybe if you're thinking grad school, then you should probably be looking into doing research. And at the time, I was taking organic chemistry, and I can't believe I'm about to admit this to two organic chemists, but I was not all that awesome at organic chemistry, and I did not love it. And so I was sitting there feeling very daunted by the fact that I was sitting in this great research institution with a lot of organic chemists in it and not really interested in joining their labs. And so I was looking at all of the faculty profiles at BU and was sort of drawn to inorganic chemistry, partially because I hadn't taken the class yet. And I thought, well, I know I love chemistry and I know I want to be doing this, but I'm not sure I want to be doing organic chemistry. So what else can I do? What can I show myself right now that I could get involved with? And so taking a look at the professors who do inorganic chemistry at Boston University, it's much smaller. There's only like three people who are really dedicated in organic chemistry. And of those, two of them are quite bio inorganic chemistry. And I didn't think I really wanted anything to do with bio. And so what is really just sort of led to me reaching out to Professor Linda Dorr and saying, hey, could we chat? Could I maybe maybe do a summer working for you, see where it goes. And just, I mean, the first time that I met her, I thought sort of hand in hand, what she does seems really cool, developing these metal complexes. And she really got me like right off the bat. She's like, even if you don't exactly know why you want to do organic, inorganic chemistry, the reason I got into it was because of all the colors. So like something small like that could still be a reason to want to do inorganic chemistry at the start. But right from there, I saw that she is someone that I probably thought I want to have as a mentor. Like from that first conversation, I thought that she would be a great resource and a great mentor to have. And why not give a try something that I hadn't thought of yet? And it hasn't ended since. So I think that I made a good choice.
Yeah, that's awesome. I actually know Linda Dorr. I did an REU at Boston like the summer before my junior year. So like, no, the summer before my senior year. So you were probably about
So I think we just missed each other.
Yeah. So I think she was like one of the people in charge of like the REU program.
Oh, thing, interesting. So. That's awesome. Well, yes, she is near and dear to my heart.
That's really awesome.
That's nice. So then moving forward a little bit, going to graduate school, how was that transition to Michigan? And do you feel supported by the chemistry department or in your lab as an LGBTQ plus person?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, my transition to Michigan was mostly really excellent. I was really excited to be here and super excited to move on to the next portion of my life, graduate school. Wow. But at the same time, it was difficult because I've never lived anywhere other than the East Coast before that. And so most of my family on the East Coast, certainly my partner was living on the East Coast, lots of friends that I had spent the last 4 years building a giant tight-knit community of, always difficult to move away from things like that. But I did feel like I had a ton of support out here right from the get-go. I think on a personal level, I have a cousin who was a student here. And I know that the sort of joke is that, you know, every family has a gay cousin, but we got really lucky because we have two. And so it was kind of nice. So it was kind of nice that knowing that coming out here, I did have somebody who knows me super personally, is, you know, knows my family things and also does understand that being identifying as LGBTQ+ and you know being able to talk about that in the context of Michigan. But even without that, I think that I would have felt incredibly supported anyway, because I do feel like we have a really supportive department here. I think you guys probably agree, as I've heard on the podcast. But but yeah, I can just agree with you there. Not only do we have people like Anne McNeil who developed the sticker, the Rainbow Periodic Table, you are welcome here, but the first time I was given one of those stickers, it was in our administrator's office with our grad coordinator. It was like, I think you would want one of these, and just handed it to me. And I got, my heart in that moment was like, oh my gosh, I came here to ask you about what cognate I should take, and here I am walking away with this sticker and feeling really good about myself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and in my lab too, I think that I felt supported every single minute I've been there. My boss has one of those stickers on his door. So, I mean, even little things like that where I can walk down the hall and know that I am welcome here because the sticker says so. But yeah, when I was doing my rotation, I found out that they had had a previous grad student go through the lab and graduate with his PhD. And he had been a gay man. And that, I don't know if it really super swayed my decision because I was already very into my rotation. I loved the research I was doing, but I obviously can't say that that hurt hearing that somebody who identifies as LGBTQ+ had made it all the way through that lab and had felt supported the whole time being there. I think that that just told me like, hey, anything you might've thought like this lab is a great place to be. And I felt that way every day.
That's great. Yeah. That's so nice when you feel that way.
Yeah, my gosh.
So going along with that, do you think that there's anything that this department can do better in terms of being more inclusive towards LGBTQ+ people?
I don't. I mean, I think that obviously, like, there's always room for improvement. Yeah. I think that across the board, everybody can always be thinking of new and better ways to be inclusive and try to support and foster an environment that more LGBTQ people want to be joining. But at the same time, I think that our department does have that. And so in terms of like specific details that they can be doing better, I don't really have any. Like, I think that I, as my own personal experience being LGBTQ plus in this department, I feel very welcomed. And so personally, I wouldn't really feel like I need anything else. But mm-hmm. at the same time, everybody has their own journey and everybody feels what they feel. And if somebody wanted or thought that we could be doing something more, then I'm certain that I would agree and would be more than happy to do what I can to make that a place, because now that I'm here in this department, I fall under the what can we be doing better.
Yeah,
definitely. That's one of the reasons I don't think this is public yet, but Beck and I just recently founded an LGBTQ plus affair committee with the CGSC.
Oh my god!
This summer, yeah. So we're like working towards that, getting plans for that, so we can be, you know, this kind of support system that if anybody in our department needs like to talk about, you know, something LGBTQ related, we can be that. I don't know how the name of like a person, you know, someone to go to and talk about it, and then we can talk to the department and other things and so much other things like trainings and workshops and stuff like that. So we're on the works of doing that, since we're so excited to do that.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. Wow. Yeah. So I mean, right there, I mean, that's above and beyond. I'm impressed.
I think it's been really cool doing this podcast, because we have gotten to talk to so many different people from different departments, and there are definitely departments that are significantly lacking in a lot of the support that even we see here at Michigan. And then there are departments who do really well when it comes to LGBTQ plus advocacy and supporting their students. But I think you're right. I think there's always things that we can be doing. And I think like through doing this project, we've learned a lot about what is working well, what is not working well across the country. What are like events that like sound amazing that would like, of course, Michigan would totally be down to do, because it is such a supportive department. But I think like this, like selfishly, I think it's really just cool because we get so many ideas on like, oh my God, these are all the things that we can bring to our department, like to make it better. Because I think you're right, like it is so supportive and accepting. And also there's more we can do.
I think that to say like, yes, we are leaders in this and we do foster this great environment, to tell ourselves that we've done enough or all we can do is not true and would be doing a disservice to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So kind of a reflection question, now that you're a few years into graduate school, what kind of support do you wish you would have had coming into grad school? I think that this question is especially important as we have some first years coming in to start grad programs here and across the country.
Within the next couple weeks, is officially time. So I think that in terms of answering this question, I kind of did a bit of a disservice to myself, because what I feel like really got to me when I first started was the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And what I needed was, you know, an older student who I could go to without being worried about like having it be muddied with I'm doing rotation with you and I want to make sure that like you think I'm on top of my stuff. But I, you know, having an older student to just like talk about these things and learn early on, much earlier than I did, that everybody feels this way and you get past candidacy and you still feel like a little bit of imposter syndrome creeping up on you. But the answer to that, for at least the University of Michigan, is that, you know, we do in our department have a mentor-mentee program for first years. And I think that if I could go back just to the beginning, I would tell myself to participate in that, because that's why they had it. Like, I think I told myself, oh, don't sign up for too many things. You're going to overwhelm yourself. You need to focus on classes and teaching and research, and all three of those things put together feel terrifying before you jump into them, sometimes even while you're in them. But
yeah.
I think that not having the mentorship program be the thing that I said, oh, that I don't need, because there's a reason why it was implemented, and there's a reason why the older graduate students feel so feel like it is so important to participate in it on the other end and be that person to tell a new student, like, hey, I may look like I have things slightly more put together, but I was in your shoes. I know how you feel. I know how you, like, I have felt the way that you feel. And yeah, I mean, I think that's support I wish I had, but it's also support that I could have gotten. So it's not something that I think, you know, Michigan could do better. I think it's something that I wish I had just told myself to do, because they tried to tell me I would benefit from it. And I definitely would have.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Peer support is just the best thing to get by grad school, I would say. I mean, I'm only starting a second year, but.
But you've already got it, you know. Yeah.
Like, we have 1 year under our belt. We know everything. Clearly.
We act like we do know, but.
Yeah, we really do act like we're experts on that.
But he's still always learning. It's always fake until you make it. And even when you make it, you're still doing a little bit of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, because I definitely did make a support system of my first year friends and my cohort. And that was good and still to this day is excellent. But even with these people who were struggling alongside me, still I sometimes found myself thinking, they still know so much more than I do. And they do this and they do that. And no matter what, the imposter syndrome's there, even though, you know, you realize sometimes after the fact that it's there for everybody.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So switching gears a little bit, can you tell us about your experience as a queer woman in STEM?
Yeah, so I feel extremely fortunate that I have, like, my experience as a queer woman in STEM has been overwhelmingly positive. I have not experienced, you know, much discrimination that we hear described all over the United States and the world. I have been supported by, you know, my family as a queer woman, by my friends as a queer woman and a queer woman in STEM. But I think that what I needed and wanted as a younger queer woman was to be able to see that people like me were doing what I wanted to be doing. Mm-hmm. And so I think the place where that first was a real turning point for me was working at Boston University for Linda Doerr, because she is also LGBTQ+ in chemistry. Mm-hmm. And just seeing her as a, you know, the successful PI running this successful group and publishing and talking at talks and just like just walking the walk and talking the talk and do it told me that, oh, you know, it's not that nobody makes it past this point. Like, it's not that you are, you know, the first person to be doing this or the last person to be doing this. Like, there are people who come before and people who come after, and to be able to see them in that position, I think I have been extremely fortunate because there are not an overwhelming number of LGBTQ professors in academia. And I don't actually want to go into academia. I think I'm more on the continue doing chemistry for the rest of my life train. But I think, so there, I just haven't had a ton of really involvement with like industry things yet at the point I am in my life. And so something that I will be looking for someday is to make sure that I can still sort of see that and have that representation, because that's what helps me. And I know that everyone's, you know, experiences and desires and needs are very personalized. And so I think for me, it was just seeing that someone who looks or feels or whatever like I do can do this, and therefore I can also do this. And it's not, you know, unthinkable to think that someone can have a partner and be married to someone who's not in a heteronormative relationship and still be incredibly successful and have it not, you know, at all, I would say, get in the way of her professionalism or success in life. And I just want to embody that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's really, yeah, that's amazing. And just so cool that like you had that experience of working with like a queer woman as your PI. Like that is, I mean, you're right. There is such a small number, it feels like, of LGBTQ+ professors in general in chemistry. And then when you look even further of like your specific field, and then you look even further of like, well, like, are they like a man, a woman, trans, non-binary? It's like even smaller, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just like, it is, I think that like, I do feel inspired by most of the, like, not, if not all of the LGBTQ+ chemists that we talk to. But I think like when I do meet somebody who has like a little bit more of that shared experience, like maybe like non-binary or something like that, like some identity that I also hold, it's just like that much more like, damn, like I really can do this. Like I can do this. Like even if, like you're saying, like you don't have to go into academia to like find this person to be like a great role model, and just knowing that like you can be successful and happy and also LGBTQ. So.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember when I was then sort of in the thick of looking at grad schools and doing that application program, I remember sitting in her office one day and like, she was the one who brought up like, oh, I know that you have your partner, Anna, and so you might be regionally limited and we should just talk about that now. And just having her be the one to bring that up and to acknowledge that, like, yes, I was in a relationship and it was not what a lot of, like most of my other lab mates, like if they were to discuss their relationship or anything, it was different. And just hearing that come out of her mouth first toward me and just automatically being like, I know that you're in this relationship and I know that this matters to you because this matters. And if this is something that is something you're keeping in mind for grad school, we should just talk about that because that's important. Yeah. And that made me feel so secure in, I mean, having her as my mentor and moving forward as this queer woman in chemistry.
That's amazing. So kind of going along with that, you've mentioned to us that you've been in a long distance relationship with your partner during your entire time in graduate school so far. So can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how has that been for you?
Yeah, so I would definitely not be telling the truth if I said it was super easy all the time, because it's definitely hard and I wish I could be with my partner all of the time. But at the same time, I have these goals, and these goals are to spend this time in the Midwest getting a PhD, and my partner, they have goals as well. And I think that it's super important and has been really rewarding over this time, these officially 2 full years so far, that they have been able to get a full-time job. They graduated from school, got a full-time job, been following their own dreams and what they like to do, and being able to watch them be successful in exactly what they want to do, while they can kind of from the other end watch me be successful and in doing my training and what I want to do. And so it's very rewarding to know that we're both doing exactly what we want to do and not holding each other back in any way, regionally or otherwise. And at the same time, still having that support system every single day. Like, I would not be able to do any of this without them. And my heart goes out to them every single day, even though they're in Boston and I am here in Michigan. But yeah, so difficult, but worth it every single day. I think that we made the right choice and have continued to make the right choice to do this for, I think, all of my PhD.
Wow.
It's amazing to have that support.
Yeah.
If only we knew.
Geraldo and I are just like, wow, I'm not crying. I'm not crying. Oh, man. No. Like, we love
and also technology.
Yeah.
No, like, I say that if I could thank one thing, it would be FaceTime, because I don't know how people did this before FaceTime with letters and phone calls and. But yeah, no, it has been so good.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah, that's really great to hear.
So what advice would you give to your younger self? And it could be about anything.
Yeah, so advice. I guess this advice comes in two parts. I guess to the 13-year-old girl sitting in her bedroom reading everyoneisgay.com, you're not alone. And you don't need to be so worried. And your fears that you will never have a girlfriend are unfounded, and you just need to calm yourself and breathe a little bit, because everything really is going to be okay. And I really wish that I could be a 13-year-old hearing that right now from myself, because if someone else had told me, I wouldn't have believed them. Mm-hmm. But truly, everything has worked out so far. My life has certainly not come to its penultimate moment yet. But yeah, I guess to the chemistry student budding as an undergrad and getting interested in chemistry, I would tell that girl to read more literature, because the faster that you get into knowing how to read and what to read and getting just really excited about the literature is only going to help you on the back end when it becomes, you know, a large percentage of what I do every day and what goes into coming up with my own ideas. And yeah, so advice in two parts to Emily and two different eras of her life.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I was better at reading the literature. maybe I'll get better, hopefully.
I'm definitely still getting better.
Yeah, definitely. So you are a self-proclaimed lover of chinchillas. Can you tell us a little bit about that love? And then also, what is your favorite random fact about chinchillas? I know that, like, I know absolutely nothing, so I will be amazed at whatever you say.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. There are so many facts, and truly all of them are my favorite, because I adopted a chinchilla, gosh, I think it was 4 years ago at this point, somewhere around there. And I quickly learned that you cannot adopt a chinchilla without learning everything there is to know about a chinchilla, because they are delicate creatures. They are a large rodent native only to the Andes Mountains. So you can imagine taking a creature that's only native to the Andes Mountains out of the Andes Mountains, and now it's my job to keep it alive. But yeah, so you asked for one fact, so I will give you one fact, but chinchillas are widely renowned as the softest mammal. And this is not just hearsay. They really are the softest mammal. To put it in perspective, humans have 2 to 3 hairs per hair follicle. Chinchillas have about 40 to 50. And so when you pet a chinchilla, sometimes it feels more like you're petting a cloud than actually petting a chinchilla. So you can imagine.
That is so cute.
We have to meet your chinchilla now. Like, we have to.
Yes, I can definitely arrange that. I can give you a photo also to post with the.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. Yes, please,
Luna is very excited about inorganic chemistry as well.
Yeah.
But no, you can imagine coming home after a long and stressful day in lab and just giving a chinchilla a pet. Aww. Really helps.
That's so cute.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So I know this was not in the questions, but how, like, do you have time? I guess you do, like, to take care, like, good care of your, like, pet being in grad school.
Yeah, so luckily chinchillas, for the most part, just kind of want to be left alone. She lives in what is referred to as the chinchilla mansion. So she lives in a cage that is much larger than she is. And so she gets a lot of exercise in there every day. And so for the most part, she is an animal that just kind of lives in a cage. I let her out into a pen and she runs around. And so, you know, there's not a whole lot of like a dog where you have to walk it multiple times a day and really be worrying about it. As long as I give her enough time to sort of run around outside of the cage a little bit every day or so, she's perfectly happy to just kind of be my emotional support chinchilla.
Oh, that's so cute.
That is so cute. I'm like dying to see a picture. So,
I know.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Absolutely.
I'm also like
happy to provide.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you are in the same department as us so that we get to pet a chinchilla.
Yes, you can actually meet the chinchilla, 100%.
Yeah.
So this is one of Beck's favorite questions, but I get to ask it. Well, who is your chemistry role model and why?
Yeah, so this is definitely a hard question because there are so many people that kind of came to mind initially, both like role model versus like idol, like people who I really, really respect the chemistry that they do versus, you know, people who, since I've gotten more involved or, you know, involved, I like to scroll through chem Twitter. seeing, you know, people who are really here for like mental health advocacy. But to answer your question, I think that I wanted to come a little closer to home for who I really think of as my role models and say that I have been super fortunate to work with two different postdoc mentors, both in my time in undergrad and in graduate school. And I have just learned so much from them. And I have like so much of my own chemistry development to thank them for. And so I think really like in terms of role model and like being a mentor and being a great chemist, you know, having a PhD as an undergrad especially, that was incredibly impressive. So yeah, I really do want to throw it out to Dr. Chris Kodak and Dr. John Kernicki, who I both have worked with closely and have been able to help me foster my own love of chemistry and skill set in it. And so I think that I do want to just look up to them and become them for someone one day, whether it's in a postdoc position exactly or what have you. I just really do think of them as being really influential into my career.
That's awesome.
Keeping it a little closer to home.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the reasons why I love this question is because there are just a wide range of answers because we all like take the words role model as as different. And I think you're right. They're like the people that we just idolize and mm-hmm. the people that we respect intensely because of their science. And then like the day-to-day mentors and relationships that we build. So there's just like a wide range of.
Yeah. And just having role models from all facets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, to each their own 100%.
Definitely. So last question, where can people follow you on social media if they want to connect with you?
Yeah, so happy to connect on Twitter. Like I said, I'm a little bit more of a scroller than an active poster. But if you want to keep up with my antics in the SimCheck Lab, then you can follow me at Emily Norwine. It is just my name on Twitter.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I think that was all we had. But thank you so much for this.
Yes, thank you so much. This was so much incredible.
Yeah.
Great to talk to you guys and, you know, a facet outside of the walls of the chemistry building.
Yeah.
Not that there's a lot of mingling going on in the chemistry building right now.
No,
but.
I know. So sadly. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is fantastic.
Yeah. I'll talk to you later. Bye. We have big plans to expand this project by purchasing higher quality recording equipment and creating a website, merch, and at some point doing live shows. Because of this, we decided to start a Patreon account in which y'all can become monthly donors of the show. Even if you pledge to donate $2 a month, you'll be greatly impacting the future of this project. We hope that y'all will continue to support us by becoming patrons.
There are 78 days until the election, and with the pandemic and attack on our U.S. Postal Service, it's incredibly important to request your mail-in ballots and send them in at least a few weeks before the election. Every state has different rules about mail-in voting, so you can find more information in the link in our Twitter bio. And as always, remember to fill out the nomination form on our Twitter if you're interested in being interviewed for the show. You can follow us at MFQCpod. Take care, everybody, and stay safe. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Adios.